is an elastic planet. Things bounce, things cohere, and things snap. On a desert island deep in the Indian Ocean, it is another perfect day. The sun burns white throughout the morning, and by mid-afternoon, remarkably little has happened at all. But what is this, bebobbing on the next wave to reach the sandy shore? It is a chest from a shipwreck. Marked on the side is the legend HMS Unsinkable and the initials AI. But it's what's inside it that concerns us most. A spoon, a plate, some underpants, a tin of paint. What could be the connection between these everyday objects? And what possible association could they have with the flamenco guitar? All will be made clear.
Ah, yeah, that's the Italian Fire Brigade, 1984 to 88.
Says Lawrence Dunton House, a siren writer from Manchester, on Radio 5's Sounds Different.
You're absolutely right. Do you know every siren in Europe?
Well, I wrote that one, so I should know it. I think next it goes like this.
Lawrence's studio is a veritable Aladdin's cave of electronics and horns. We were lucky enough to catch Britain's top young siren writer as he took a break from his hectic schedule to talk to Sounds Different. Why do people come to you to write their sirens?
Well, for a number of reasons. After a while, you get used to hearing, say, a police car, and it doesn't have the required effect anymore. I mean, you hear this, and you think, oh, it's just a police car. Not, oh, it's a police car, which is what they want you to think, obviously.
It's a matter of image, then.
Yeah, they want a modern siren that says, you know, get out of the way, or don't worry, we're here, and they come to me to give it to them.
So what are you working on right now?
This? It's the European Community's Uniform Ambulance Siren, due to come in next year. The idea is that wherever in Europe you hear this, everyone will know it's an ambulance. So I'm mixing in bits of Greek ambulance with some of the more upbeat stuff coming out of Germany these days to try and give it that pan-European feel.
Lawrence's mother is Dame Wendy House, the first Minister for Society under the Macmillan government, and the designer of the children's play area to which she gave her name. After retiring from public life, she writes a history of spoon development in Britain.
Think back to the early 19th century, the start of our information age. More people could read, and they were reading more things, like recipes.
Add one dessert spoon of salt, a level soup spoon of pepper, and a wooden spoon of cauliflower suet.
But what were the dimensions and volumes of these spoons? In the West Country, a tablespoon had been traditionally large, whereas in London the fashion was for daintiness. And this led to chaos in the kitchen, summed up by Punch in their famous cartoon, Marching to a Different Spoon. The government had to be brought in, and in May of 1840, the National Spoon Design Competition was launched, with considerable relief and anticipation. At last, Britain would get a standard dessert spoon. The three finalists were these spoons. The Britannia from Derby, the Classic from London, and over here, an early favourite, the Caledonian from Aberdeen. Queen Victoria herself judged the merits of each spoon. The weight, the volume held, the lip, the curve of the handle, all these factors were taken into account. She even tested them at royal banquets, checking the fronts of guests' shirts afterwards to see the dribble coefficient. Anyway, on Christmas Day 1840, the Britannia was named the Imperial Standard Spoon, and to this day it remains the most used spoon in the Commonwealth. In 1962, the greatest honour of all was bestowed upon the Britannia when the Cutlery Commission of the United Nations voted it the Global Spoon Standard. Recipe writers and ordinary spoon users alike hailed this small tool that had conquered the world.
The designer of the Britannia is Lloyd Garth Manhandling, a distant cousin of Sir Aelio Nemborth, the Swiss banker, who becomes the first non-Roman Catholic pope in 1836. Manhandling's fame is short-lived, however, when in 1844 he falls victim to Donald Dutting's disease and his days of cutlery design are numbered. The father of the modern spoon dies penniless in 1869, his workshop remaining empty for nearly 20 years, until another great inventive genius takes it over in 1888. He is Arthur Bennett, the man behind modern underpants, and his story is told in the 1957 MGM film, Bennett.
Arthur, are you still up, dear? Oh, you're working yourself far too hard. You are. Couldn't you just slow down for a while? Please, Arthur, for me.
Oh, Rose, you are such a sweet, sweet thing. But don't you see, I've got to do this. I can't let the Prussians get to the secret of the new underwear first. I simply can't. Imagine the power they would have then.
The screenplay writer is Ray Fren, a former spit dancer from South Dakota, who comes to Hollywood to make a name for himself.
I mean, this was it for me. The guy who took old-style underwear, well, they were more or less diapers, nappies, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
And gave the world the pants we recognize today. It sweeps through this epic story. Napoleon's Edict de Pont, the Prussian pants strict in. I even had a scene with Abraham Lincoln's drawers. Now, this was big-budget stuff. MGM's big movie of the year.
What was the hardest scene to write?
Now, the actual moment. You know, when Bennett is exhausted, but he knows he's done it, and the world gets to learn of his breakthrough.
That's it. Here, in front of me, I've done it. By George, I have pants. God be praised for pants.
That's right, bud. Englishman Arthur Bennett today and I'm...
The Pont de Futur sont arrivés, monsieur.
Achtung, die Tosen der Eingescheiden, Sie haben...
Los pantalones de futuro están llegado aquí, señor. Arturo Benes el hombre.
The news spread all over the world by telephone.
Yep.
38 years before Bell invents the telephone.
Fren's career comes to an abrupt end when his anachronistic telephone device is exposed in Variety, and he returns in disgrace to Dakota. After his return, he works throughout the 60s and 70s as a synchronized paddling instructor. One of his pupils is Lacey Trunker, heiress of Wellnow Trunker, the paint king of the West. The tomboyish 6-year-old Lacey learns her way in the business by joining her father's firm in the paint naming department. Despite her lack of years, she is promoted to senior vice president and assigned to the company's Geneva office. This move provokes wide interest due to the importance of Switzerland in the international paint market.
Switzerland's paint business is worth around 15 billion francs per year, and it's been like that since 1970, when the tactical paint deposit was commissioned deep under Mont Blanc. There, the Swiss government stores a gallon of emulsion for every man, woman and child in the country. Why? Swiss Minister for Planning, Kukon Schmelt.
In the event of nuclear war, though we are neutral, we will be affected. There will be destruction and mess, but with our precautions, Switzerland will be able to redecorate itself, while all else in Europe will be mere dust, scorched walls and ashes. It is projected the global paint industry will take decades to recover. But we Swiss will have nice walls again quickly, and that is something that is very important to us.
Schmelt is the great-nephew of Louis Lacroix, the inventor of washing-up liquid. Before the Great War, people would use their plates just once and then throw them away, soiled. But in 1915, the combination of Lacroix's new washing-up liquid and a shortage of clay to make new plates began to revolutionize our crockery habits. The Tatler's Miss Ethel column observed,
"Whether or not washing up, as the new fashion is termed, will last the war is open to question. But, dear reader, Miss Ethel has tried eating off reused plates and has found it acceptable. Clearly, for those who can afford to, the purchase of new plates for each meal will remain de rigueur. There can be nothing like the freshness of fresh food on fresh platage. Lacroix's liquid is certainly admirable, but no doubt has a limited appeal to those for whom crockery is no mockery."
The Miss Ethel column is written anonymously by Venetia Manhandling, daughter of the spoon designer Lloyd Garth. Her grandson, Nerin Manhandling, is a keen motorcyclist and vicar, and he combines both interests at the 1978 Royal Tournament.
And entering the arena now, from Salisbury, the Church of England Motorcycle Display Team, please welcome the White Mitres!
And what a splendid sight they make. They enter the stadium in cross formation, five men high at the top there. The team is nine strong, all ranking archdeacon and above, and they've been together for 6.5 years. Their leader, the Reverend Donald Fromart, told me before the show, it's not all smells and bells or tea and cakes in the C of E. It's also nuts and bolts and twists and turns. God gives us the grace, he says, to do these stunts. And now, to the tune of Abide With Me, the team are riding their 125cc Triumph Luthers in an intricate series of moves they call Parting the Red Sea. Magnificent. After the tournament, however, controversy. The choreographer of the Twirly Bird Motorcycle Majorettes, one of the other display teams, complains to organisers that the White Mitres' artistry was achieved by the use of performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah, that display. I mean, with all due respect, these being men of the cloth and all, but we think it was impossible unless they were using something illegal. I think the organisers should carry out a urine test, and, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they found Exactol in every sample. That's all I'm saying.
Exactol is indeed found, and the White Mitres are dismissed by the Anglican and motorcycling communities alike. Nerin Manhandling accepts his punishment, but is unrepentant.
Yes, we used Exactol, but it wasn't as though we needed it. It just added to the skill. It didn't create it.
It made your movements exact?
Yes, all the routines were neater when we took it, but we were good enough anyway.
What have been the side effects?
Well, I've stopped using it now, but when I was on it, I was tremendously fastidious about things. The house, the garden, spelling, food, dressing, posture, punctuality, lists.
Nerin leaves the church and marries one of his parishioners, Gwen Boodley. In the early 70s, she is an actress, and as such records some tapes for the Speaking Clock, when the post office is considering going over to the binary clock system.
At the third stroke, it will be 11110 minutes past 10 and 101000 seconds precisely.
Gwen's first marriage to heavyweight boxer Larry Boodley ends in 1972, when he converts to Orthodox Judaism and takes the name Abraham Isaacson. As the Hendon Hebruiser, he fights 20 opponents and loses to all of them. Then, in 1976, he walks out on Gwen and their two children, Golda and Moisha. He enlists in the Merchant Navy as an interior decorator and sets to sea on the HMS Unsinkable. It is his trunk, then, containing the plate, the spoon, the pants and the paint, that washes ashore on the desert island. And the significance of the flamenco guitar? Ah, well, not everything has to be relevant.
Elastic Planet was written by Ben Moore and featured the voices of Oliver Postgate, Rebecca Front, Jeff McGiven, Dan Strauss, Kerry Shale and Ben Moore, with Karen Keating and Raymond Baxter as themselves. The producer was John Naismith.